May it please the Court. My name is Chris Bergen, and I represent the appellant in this case, Norma Vasquez-Orellana. This case comes before Your Honors on our petition for review of the BIA's decision denying our appeal of the immigration judge's decision to pre-termit my client's application for special rule cancellation of removal under the NACARA Act. The issues in this case are twofold. One is we believe the BIA's decision is flawed, and number two, we have to deal with whether my client was actually convicted of an aggravated felony under INA 101A43Mi. The relief that we're requesting is that this court remand the case back to the BIA with instructions to send it back to the immigration court to allow my client to apply for special rule cancellation of removal under NACARA.
Now, moving to say, Mr. Bergen,
yes.
Given particularly the standard of review that we face, it's awfully hard not to see this as a case, the underlying felony, that is, as a case in which the victim, Enterprise, suffered any loss less than $13,000, and she was jointly and severally responsible for that. So isn't that pretty much it for her?
Well, no, Your Honor. Respectfully, we believe that the record of conviction, as we've stated in our brief, does not actually state a loss amount in the loss column at all. In other parts of the record of conviction, there's less than $10,000 listed.
But the government explains how that comes about. I mean, first of all, co-defendants, you know, she still owes the $9,750. She's directed immediately to pay a lump sum of $9,850, which is just how when you work your way through the math, that's what you get up to. But it's hard for me to see how the board can be seen as abusing its discretion to see this as a felony involving more than, you know, fraud involving more than $10,000. Unless you're trying to say the board's not entitled somehow to look at the overall fraud in a joint operation like this car fraud business was.
Well, Your Honor, there is the whole issue of the Taylor-Shepard framework, although that's going to be decided apparently by the Supreme Court in Nijuan. So even
the Supreme
if
Court keeps taking stabs at that one.
Yes, exactly. But as this court, even if we assume, as this court did in Ali, that you can look beyond the record of conviction. Now, I understand you're saying you believe the record of conviction by itself proves that.
Well,
that's more
what,
than
first 30. Of all, that's what the immigration judge finds. Secondly, that's what the board finds. Thirdly, you look at the record of conviction, where the judgment says restitution is to be paid to the victim in the amount of $13,000. By the various co-defendants, and I just am having trouble finding my way clear to a path that would show something less than $10,000 or less, I should say.
Well, Your Honor, we did provide to the court and the BIA, and the BIA didn't really mention any of these things, but as we mentioned in our brief, you know, the total loss column is blank. Now, that's unfortunate that the district court judge didn't list the loss amount. There was a release of all claims that my client signed with the insurance company of the rental car place for $10,000, release of all claims, which is not more than $10,000.
That's part of the fraud trend. I mean, we have the two transactions, right? The fraud where she says, I'm releasing you for $10,000, right?
Correct.
And then later on, there's mail fraud prosecution, where people are rethinking the numbers.
Well, there's no plea colloquy, there's no plea agreement. In my client's criminal defense lawyer's memorandum, you know, they state clearly that she did not knowingly have a loss of more than $10,000, the $13,000 that you're mentioning.
But look, I'm looking at the judgment in a criminal case,
yes.
In 04 CR 249-2,
Yes, sure.
Which is in the district court here. And if you get over to about the fourth page of that judgment, you come to the part where there's an X, the defendant must make restitution, including community restitution, to the following payees, blah, blah. Enterprise Rent-A-Car, restitution ordered $13,000. So it is right here on this judgment, at least.
Well, Your Honor, then I would state that, well, what is restitution the same as loss as the statute defines
loss? That's what restitution
loss
is for a loss.
Well, but why would they have a separate column for loss and restitution?
I have the foggiest idea, but the word restitution implies a loss.
Right.
Don't perform restitution if there hasn't been a loss.
Well, but sometimes you can...
It's not a fine. Restitution means recompensing for what was gone.
But other times courts have ordered more restitution than the actual loss.
You're saying that there's a broad thing that they must follow exactly in order to arrive at the same conclusion.
Yes.
Well, I disagree with you, so we move.
Okay. And, Your Honors, what we believe is that the release of all claims here is crucial because it says 10,000, of which my client actually only received $3,000+. And also on the conditions of probation, which also was issued right after the judgment, it says that my client owes jointly and severally $9,750. Now that, why would she owe jointly and severally $9,750?
She already paid them.
Well, but did the other defendants pay that?
But it's jointly.
How would it be jointly and severally?
They're still jointly liable. She went up front and paid part of it. That doesn't relieve her of the other balance.
But then why would the other ones be jointly and severally for $9,750 if they never paid?
They got a good deal because your client paid up front.
Well, Your Honors, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. Ann Wellhoff for Respondent Attorney General Holder. May it please the Court. Your Honor, the only evidentiary burden in this case that the government bore was the burden to prove that petitioner was removable. The government more than satisfied that burden. In fact, petitioner conceded removability. On the other hand, the petitioner in this case bore the burden of proving she was eligible for the relief which she sought. In this case, she sought special rule cancellation of removal and asylum. The immigration judge pretermitted both of those applications. And I would point out initially that I didn't hear petitioner's counsel mention anything about asylum in his opening. And really, that's the only thing that's left for her at this point. The immigration judge pretermitted the application and alternatively found she did not have good moral character. That alone, whether or not she's an aggravated felon, precludes NACRA relief. That finding stands unchallenged. And is final. So even if the court were to find she wasn't an aggravated felon and send it back, the only thing on the table is asylum at this point. Now, having clarified that, again, the petitioner bore the burden of coming forward by showing, preponderance of the evidence, that she was entitled to the relief. Petitioner, based on the board's analysis, failed to meet her burden of proof. This court, the only issue before this court is whether that determination is grounded in substantial evidence. That is a fact-bound inquiry that the board made, weighed the evidence, and came to the conclusion she failed to persuade under the applicable standard of preponderance of the evidence. This petitioner has pointed to absolutely nothing in the record that would compel a contrary conclusion. There's a lot of in my view, smokescreen here with the Shepard-Taylor analysis and what impact, if anything, the Supreme Court's ultimate ruling in this case will have. And I would submit that that there will be, regardless of how the court rules, that is not going to affect the result here. And the reason is because the petitioner bears the burden of proof here. We're not in a situation where the respondent is attempting to meet his burden of proving removability on account of an ag felon, in which case Shepard-Taylor and the codification thereof would be applicable. That's not what we're looking at here. We are, again, on the petitioner's burden. There's absolutely no constraints on the petitioner regarding the types of evidence she could come forward with. There's no Shepard-Taylor constraints on her. Conversely, there would be no constraints on the government in rebutting that. And, in fact, in this case, the petitioner did come forward with all of the evidence, many of which are not even really within the permissible evidentiary cast under Shepard-Taylor. So the Shepard-Taylor arguments on petitioner's brief really, I would say, cut against him. This was petitioner's evidence, every bit of it. If you read through the record, I went through very carefully and took some notes on when the immigration judge admitted each piece of evidence and whose evidence was it. And as Your Honors review this case and look at the record, I believe you will find that the evidence was petitioner's. So, again, this is a matter of, and interestingly, before the immigration judge and before the board and even before this court, petitioner's argument has been all along, the evidence is confusing, it's inconclusive. The petitioner argued to the immigration judge, the evidence is convoluted at Administrative Record 117. Argued to the board, the record of conviction is unclear. Even if we can look outside the record is not clear. To this court, petitioner's brief at page 7, again, arguing the evidence is unclear. There is no support for the proposition that coming forward with vague and unclear evidence is sufficient to meet your burden of proof. So even if you accept his arguments, he has not met the burden of proof and certainly has not pointed to any compelling evidence that would demand a determination other than what the board reached in this case.
Why in the judgment of conviction is restitution in most places redacted?
Well, Your Honor, you raise a very good point, because when I went through the evidence, I noticed that, again, Your Honor, was petitioner's proffered evidence, and you'll be able to see that at Administrative 87 and 88. Petitioner, again, in furtherance of his burden of proof, proffers to the court a document that he chose to redact, perhaps information that would, in fact, perhaps cut. He selectively crossed off information that may be material to the very question that the board had. Petitioner did that as well. If you look at the exhibit memorandum, government's version of the offense to the U.S. Probation Office, it's Exhibit 7, and it's found at Administrative Record 118 through 122. There's redactions in there again. It would seem that, you know, again, the government cannot be, their hands can't be tied as to what evidence they can look at when petitioner's proffering the evidence and actually selecting what portions of the documents the court can consider. Now, I would point out that the judgment of conviction, by the time the case reached the board, petitioner did submit an unredacted version. You can find that one. And I'm not sure what prompted him to do that, but that was done. And that one is at Administrative Record, page 30. And you will, if you compare the two documents, you will find that the portions that were redacted pertain to the restitution and how much was ordered to be paid.
What was the amount?
$13,000, Your Honor.
Same as the unredacted part of this.
Correct. And so, again, I would put, you know, focus the court on what the issue here is really. It's a fact-bound inquiry, whether this petitioner satisfied her burden of persuasion, and that's subject to the substantial evidence standard, extremely deferential in this case, and petitioner has not pointed to anything in the record that would compel a contrary conclusion. And one last point, there was some discussion on the initial presentation about why there's no loss stated on the judgment of conviction, and I would submit that loss is not an element of this crime. That's one of the reasons we're looking at the loss in the context of the Ali case and Babojevic, where when you're trying to determine a non-elemental portion of a disqualifying factor or an aggravated felony, you may look at any body of evidence. In other words, the loss was not an element of the crime. We've never said it was. And I would submit that is most likely why it's not in the actual judgment. Unless the court has any questions, I'll thank you.
Thank you very much. How much time? You have 3 minutes.
Your Honors, first I got to, I guess, defend my honor. The administrative record, possibly that was highlighted or something by, the administrative record comes from the government. I guess, I don't know if I didn't look and see if there was a highlight or, I don't know, but I did not redact.
Well, it looks like it's redacted, but
I did not redact.
I agree with you,
any.
It could be highlighted too. But
it could have been highlighted by the immigration judge and then copied in the record, and that's why it comes out black, but I absolutely did not do that. Couple things. Counsel mentions the good moral character issue. That's not in the briefing. That wasn't briefed, so I didn't respond to that. She mentions asylum is an issue I didn't bring up. Well, we're not appealing on the asylum issue at all, so I don't even know why we brought that up.
But I thought she wasn't eligible for the NACARA relief if there was an independent finding of lack of good moral character.
Well, that wasn't briefed on either side, and it wasn't an issue that I thought was...
Okay.
They didn't bring that up as an issue, so I had no idea that was going to be today. A couple things. You know, the counsel talks a lot about the unclear evidence. I guess... maybe it was a bad choice of words, but what the point of our point was in that is that the conviction record does not show that the loss to the victim was more than $10,000. And that's unfortunate, but that's the case. The district court judge left various things blank, put various other numbers under $10,000 on his judgment of conviction. That's not my client's fault. And so to take away her life here in the United States after having been here 23 years, she filed for asylum in 92, and the government themselves sat on the case until she was convicted of this crime in 2005. And then in 2007, 15 years later, then they said, we're going to deny your asylum and put you into court. So it's interesting that they can...
And in the meantime, lots of things in Guatemala have changed.
Yeah, although not all for the best, as the State Department reports clearly show. There's still gross amount of human rights violations. There's not a civil war, but there's still gross amount of human rights violations, as well as the abject poverty. It's one of the poorest countries in the Americas. But nonetheless, we still believe that the board's decision, I mean, even in their own decision, they say that the evidence does not definitively demonstrate that the amount of loss to the victim was below $10,000. So they don't even use the correct standard in their own decision denying my client. The standard is, for an aggravated felony, more than $10,000. So that's a mistake. Definitively demonstrate. What does that mean as opposed to what we all usually use, preponderance of the evidence? So were they holding my client to a higher standard? So I do believe the BIA's decision was an error just simply on that alone, that it used the improper standard or a standard that we don't even know whether it was proper or not. And they clearly misstated the more than $10,000 standard. And also, finally, we do believe that it is not an aggravated felony because the record of conviction does not support that. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.